Ladies and gentlemen, in just a few moments, we start our daily broadcast.
Who listens to radio?
Hi, I'm Dave Denton. I'm a radio guy, and even went by that name on the air in Missouri. This is Radio Guy Reflections. Radio Guy Reflections is brought to you by daysvoiceworks.com with the latest podcast of Radio Guy Reflections, 3W News, and Turpical Trash. There's some pictures and interviews with my career and more. Find out how you can put Dave's voice to work for you. daysvoiceworks.com. When you spell works, it's W-O-R-X. Past guests on Radio Guy Reflections include people like Aurora Cantu, a member of the Texas Radio Hall of Fame, Salt Lake City talk show host Rod Arquette, Richard Buckle, who was part of the historic pirate radio stations in Great Britain and is now running a radio station in Thailand. But today's guest is a former coworker of mine who's had, I think, an incredible career, 14 years in radio. Then just a few more highlights include working for politicians, including former Tennessee Governor Ned Ray McWhorter. And now he is the executive director of the Nashville Songwriters Association. He hosts a weekly video print interview series on YouTube called Story Behind the Songs. And today on Radio Guy Reflections, we're talking to my friend Bart Herbison. Bart, how you doing, my man?
Feels like yesterday. I was so excited when you asked me to do this because I miss it, David. Radio is my favorite thing I've ever done. I've been blessed. I've got to do a lot of great things. But as you know, man, just sitting behind that board, nothing like it.
There's absolutely nothing like it. And I think you and I have both found out that over the years when you talk to people that have been in radio, they say, man, I wish I could go back and get another job in it or do something else with it. Because there's just nothing like radio. Even though it's changed over the years, even the people that are in it now will say, you know, there's just nothing like being behind the microphone and just having fun with what you're doing. It's a great, great profession. A little bit different than when you and I started years ago, but it's still a great thing. Bart, I'm going to throw a couple of memories down to you, and you probably don't remember this. I have two great memories of you, Bart Herbison. One of those is one day I walked into the studio at WTPR, and you were playing an album, and you looked at me, and you said, these guys are the next Beatles. And you said it was Dire Straits, Mark Knopfler and Dire Straits. And I kind of said, what are you talking about? And I think it was the Sultans of Swing that might have been playing. And, man, you know, Mark Knopfler is a legend in music now, and I got to take my hats off to you. So you were partially right about that one. So,
well, I should have said somebody besides the Beatles, but I do remember that. Yeah. I remember saying that about that record, and I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard anything up to that time like it, and I'm not sure I've heard anything like it since then. It was the songs, it was Knopfler, it was the guitar style, but it was sonically, too. Yeah. I don't remember. Maybe Knopfler was the co-producer on that, but it just sounded and still sounds amazing.
Yeah, it really does. And then the other one showed me how creative you are as a person. And that was when one day I walked in and you were just kind of putting some stuff together. And you were doing it to the tune of Charlie Daniels' band, Devil Went Down to Georgia. And you changed lyrics and it became kind of a promo for WTPR, and you did that live on the air, and I was just like, whoa, this dude has some talent. And that's my two big memories of Bart Herbison.
Well, I did it another time. I worked for the U.S. Congressman Bob Clement, and it was the top DJ in Tennessee, and really maybe the top country DJ in the world for years, was a guy named Jerry House on the big 98 WSIX. And my congressman was amazing, but when we first started, it was in a midterm. It was in the middle of a two-year congressional term.
Yeah.
And everything in the House of Representatives, your committee, your office, it's all driven by your seniority. And we were number 435. And there were some giants. There was Jimmy Quillen was the longest-serving Republican in the House of Representatives. Jim Sasser was the budget chair. Gore was on the ascension. you know, Harold Ford was chairman of the committee, Bart Gordon was, and we couldn't get any press in our own district, which was Nashville. So we had to be creative and do things. So Bob goes, man, get me on WSIX. And I said, okay. So I rewrote the lyrics to The South's Gonna Do It Again. Uh-huh. And we did a Christmas thing somehow about it. And House played it, and people went insane. And he had this whole, you know, other vision for his programming that day. And I love House. He was so spontaneous. He let the audience vote on it.
Oh, cool.
And he said, I'm going to play whatever it is. I'm going to play three Christmas songs, or I'm going to play that thing three times in a row. People lit up the phones. And that was one of our more clever plans to get on the radio against all the competition within our own congressional delegation.
Right.
And I got to know Charlie a little bit. He did a fundraiser for us. He was a great American. In my office, I inherited, and I've still got a small handful of them, the hand-signed lyrics by Pee Wee King and Red Stewart of Tennessee Waltz.
Oh, wow.
And we put those in a double-sided frame because it's the sheet music, so you can see the front and back. And I gave that to Charlie, and we were giving him a few trinkets, and he's like, here, here, here. And he unwrapped, and he went, this one goes to the house.
Aww.
And it hung in his house for the rest of his life. So I never met a nicer man. He was smart as all get out on a lot of subjects. But I don't think anybody realized how much Charlie gave back.
Oh, yeah.
I would bet you most of the shows the last 15 years he was alive were charitable. A lot of them were. Yeah. So.
Well, I got the chance to meet Charlie in mid-Missouri, and it was at a little county fair. And I remember I was backstage in their little trailer, and I had talked to Charlie for a few minutes, and someone told him a story about a young man who was dying of cancer at the time. He was in his early 20s, and he was supposed to come to that night's show, and they were going to set up a pickup bed with a hospital bed inside it so he could actually come to the show. Well, this young man took a turn for the worse right before the show and was bedridden. And I remember Charlie Daniels looking at the sheriff of the county, who I knew very well also, and he said, Sheriff White, do you know where this young man lives? And, of course, Sheriff White knew, and he says, well, let me get my guitar and my fiddle. And he took time out when he could have been preparing, having a meal, or whatever it was, and he went and spent a couple hours with this young man and praying with him and also playing him a couple of songs, and it just showed me the kind of man Charlie Daniels was, and I was so impressed with that gentleman, one of the true gentlemen in country music.
I echo every bit of that.
Yeah. Well, Bart, I wanted to ask you, because you worked at WTPR, AM and FM in Paris, Tennessee, and that's where you and I met. And then I left for a year to 2 years before I came back, and by that time you had moved on to another radio station that had just signed on in the Paris area called WMUF. I wanted to see that 14-year career, where you wound up and how you wound up from radio getting into the political spectrum and press representation. I wanted to find out more about that.
Well, here's my crazy career path.
Okay.
My father, my late father, J.B., people knew him as Herbie Herbison in Paris, painted and sandblasted. Uh-huh. And our specialty was high stuff, church steeples, water towers, bridges. And I worked for him from the time I was 13. And I miss my dad, and my brother became his partner for life. They ran that business, and my brother still runs it. It just wasn't for me. And while you love your dad, we weren't supposed to work together. That was oil and vinegar from day one. And we were at the Episcopal Church down there in Paris. It was a big ladder. I weighed maybe 100 pounds soaking wet. And he had to carry those 100-pound bags of sand up that ladder. And I did something unsafe. My dad was carrying it up. I didn't see him. I sat on it. He almost fell. And we exchanged a lot of words. I had hair down way past my shoulders. I think I had cut off a t-shirt on, and it was matted with sand and paint. But two guys from my high school, Mickey Mooney and Brad Hosford, worked at WTPR. I thought, man, if they can do it, I can do it. I walked straight to that radio station and got a job. And for some reason, they hired me. And you know, we had a couple guys there that sort of ran the station together. I won't name names. One of them hired me. The other one fired me about 50 times. And then the other one would hire me back.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons I think I stayed on in the first couple of years, because my voice sounded like Minnie Mouse, was I would work incessantly. In fact, the high school gave me permission to fill in shifts during school hours.
Wow.
And this sounds like an exaggeration, but since we had two stations, an AM on one side and an FM on the other, I'd work 60, 70. There was one time I worked a 100-hour week.
Wow.
And so for the, and by the way, I feel like they owe me about $1 million. They had something back then called the sub minimum wage, where if you were like 16 to 18, it was legal.
Right.
I found that later on for like about 15 hours, and they were supposed to pay you regular time. So I started at that radio station at 35 cents an hour. Finally got a raise to 50 and was able to buy a beat-up Volkswagen. But I love that place. WTPR is one of the oldest stations in Tennessee. And do you know what that stood for, what those call letters stood for, Dave?
No. Go, fill me in.
We Treat People Right, WTPR. Mm. And it was part of an old Dixie network, and it later sold to J-Star Broadcasting. But, you know, I kind of evolved from being a DJ, which I did my entire 14 years, into becoming the news director for a number of different reasons, mainly because it paid more.
Right.
And, you know, some ownership stuff happened at WTPR, and as happens in radio, I just wasn't happy there anymore. Mm-hmm. And a guy named Ted Johnson, who still may have the greatest radio voice ever, he was the morning man at WSM, the famous WSM in Nashville. Mm-hmm. He and his father, Howard, started WMUF in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what those call letters stood for?
No, I don't. I have no idea about that one.
Well, there were three big radio stations, I think guys, girls in that era sort of emulated, because AM was still the king when I grew up.
Right.
There was WHBQ in Memphis, mm-hmm. and two giant monster stations out of Chicago, WLS, John Records Landecker.
Oh, I love him.
Truly is my middle name.
Right.
And by the way, there's some of his air checks online, and he's still doing an FM thing. I still listen to Landecker.
Oh, so cool. He was so
well,
good.
I think I still do. He may have passed. I'm not sure. It's been a couple of years, but he's my hero. But the other one was WCFL, which ended up getting a lot of famous people themselves. I think Deez was up there for a while.
Uh-huh.
And they were on the same frequency we were, which was AM 1000. And the Johnsons had made a deal. We were going to be sister stations using the same jingle package. We were going to be, I think, WKFL. And about a week before we went on the air, and I was the first one to turn it on, I'll never forget that morning. We played Anticipation. It's the first song we ever played. I was the morning man by Carly Simon, because it had been a while. We were waiting to get that signal on the air. But something fell through with WCFL, and they had to change call letters. And Ted's dog was named Muffin, and he was on the phone with the FCC, and they said, you got to give me something now. And he tried a couple, taken. He goes, WMUF, and that became our call letters.
Mm-hmm. Well, we used to call you the Muffin Station, you know.
I bet you did.
I did that more than once. But you sounded so good. I mean, honestly, Bart, I just remember when I met you, I think it was in 77 or so, that I was just impressed with your talent. And also, you had this wonderful deep voice that you still have. But I think it was, you were who you were, no matter whether you had that microphone on or off. And I think that's what makes a successful radio person, is not having to put on airs and not being an act. It's who you are. And that was one of the things that I can say. When I listened to Bart Herbertson on the air, I was listening to Bart Herbertson, the person, and I appreciate that.
Wow, man, that's a stout compliment. I appreciate that. But look, we were lucky. We were in a small rural area.
Right.
But just in Paris, just in our era, well, just in West Tennessee, first of all, there was Gary W. Pally.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I learned from Pally was music. And we were always about the music. We were constantly fighting our program director, Bill McCutcheon.
Oh, yeah.
But it was music. And damn, there was some talent. You had so many people. You had a guy leave to go do mornings in Dallas, Tony Hamilton. You had Dean Scott that became the morning man in Detroit, like number four mark in America. Terry Hammonds that worked with us went and became the morning lady at WMC FM 100 in Memphis. Mm-hmm. Big Jim Sykes, Elvis Radio, Wolfman, Gary Mack, San Diego, WKGB. I mean, there was just a lot of talent around there. And especially in the 70s and early 80s, there was some area competition, but it just fed on each other. And I don't mean this to come across cocky, but we took radio to a whole new level over there, man. And,
right.
And we owned that town. We were involved in the community. Remember when Lon Sosh bought the stations? We went and did all the county sports teams, and we were just vital to the community. And I'm still proud of that, man. It was a heady time, Dave. So.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that the FCC, you know, wanted you to be involved with the community, and they still do. And, I mean, I like today's radio, but there's some aspects of it I don't like. And I think with the corporate radio right now, that you have lost a little bit of that connection with your small town or smaller market radio stations that sometimes that we miss on the air, being able to not talk about the missing dog, but being able to talk more about what's going on at the high school, what's going on at the small college, what's going on with, you know, small town politics and things like that. And I kind of miss that connection that some radio stations have fallen to the wayside because of corporate radio and running voice trackers and people from out of market. And it's just one of my pet peeves. And I don't know if you've seen that or not.
Well, exactly. And it's just not the same.
Right.
But even when you could do it, Paris Radio stood out, man.
Right.
It just stood out. And we were really competing with major cities in the news market. We were breaking stories statewide over there. If something happened, we were there, but we were just part of the pulse of that community. And I remember at one point on WMUF, because a bunch of the same crew went with me. I mean, I'll tell you the story. Lon and Henry Royce. When Ted first started it, went to work over there, but I went back to WTPR when Lon Sosh and Henry Royce bought it. Mm-hmm. And so they said, "Will you do it?" And at first I said no, and they were persistent. I said, "I'll do it on one condition." And I named five other people that were working at WMUF. I said, "We come as a team." Mm-hmm. And we all did, except for one individual, and she eventually came back to WTPR.
Right.
But at one point, I think we had, it was in the teens, 11, 15 radio stations in our little market. Mm-hmm. WTPR's rankings were double all of the other 10 put together, because we were just the pulse of that community for a
right.
long time, and I'm proud of it.
You should be. I mean, it was one of those things that, you know, like TPR, and I even had part of my podcast earlier this year, I talked to some of the people with the Helping Hands radio auction that TPR was so involved with, mm-hmm. and still is. And that's a unique situation for Henry County and also for Paris, Tennessee, that I think a lot of radio stations, and I've gotten a lot of feedback on that particular podcast, that they would love to be able to do that kind of thing.
Go from 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Every community, I was from Cottage Grove, would have a day, or a charity would have a day.
Right.
And you donate cakes, cookies, meatloafs, baked goods, bushel of corn, whatever. And they raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for charities there in Henry County. And it's special. Before I move on to how I left, Ma, if you want two or three great local radio stories from that era.
Oh, I love local radio stories.
Well, at WTPR, and I've tried to find one of these things. I want to buy one of those old Gates boards.
Uh-huh.
And I found a couple, but not like that one. And on the board, now, this is a little complicated, so bear with me. There was WTPR AM, which was more pop and a lot of news and sports and local programming, like the Helping Hands and our most famous program, Shop and Swap, with the county judge. You called and I got an old lawnmower, I'll swap it for a donkey. You know, and man, it was the highest rated thing around there, and just stopped, I think, last year. That thing was on the air for 70 years.
It was from the McAvoy Funeral Home.
They did it from different places, and that's where it ended up, and Judge Jackson did it. And, but we had an FM station. It was country, and so this was the craziest part. And what I did every Sunday and some a couple hours on Saturdays, you could simulcast, which meant you were running the same programming on both. But there were a few hours, there was separate programming, so I had to time the record on the FM to end so I could get over and announce the weather on the... You were running this, for an hour or two, two different completely programs.
Wow.
But when we simulcast, they had that old board switched a certain way. You'd throw the switch on the right up, and whatever you did on the AM side went out over both stations. Mm-hmm. Now, it was a big building. That building's still there. I love that building. It was an old phone company building. And we had the great old studios, the stand-up studios with the big stand-up RCA mics. And the first few years I was there, every Sunday we hosted live gospel quartets playing in there. Had a nice newsroom and all this glass. You could see through the air studio to the big talent studio into the newsroom. And on the right was the FM station. And next to it was where we made commercials.
Right.
So I said all that to say this, we talked to each other. So if you were in the newsroom or one of those things, and I threw the mic switch and the monitor switch to the left, we were talking and nobody else could hear it. Just us in the radio station. But if you threw it to the right, it was on the air. So this most hated song in my life, and I love everything, was Billy, Don't Be a Hero.
Oh, I agree.
It was out by Bo Donaldson and the Haywires. And it must have stayed on the chart for a year. We were playing that damn song every hour. I couldn't even take it. And then started going down the charts, and we went, thank God. And I think it was the group Paper Lace, who also had the hit, The Night Chicago Died. They put it out, and we had to endure it for another year. So there's a guy that's still in local radio over there named Terry Hudson. Did you know Terry?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
And so Terry was so sick of it, and one day he wrote a pornographic sort of version of that song. And every time it would come on, he'd sing it to the staff, and we'd run out of every office and sit there in the hallway and just giggle, giggle. But this day, he threw the switch to the right.
Oh,
Billy, don't be. And I can't even say the word. You couldn't do it. And man, the phones lit up, but they didn't fire him. But that was a funny, funny memory. We always, and then we taped it to where it said right, left. But that was crazy. And stuff like that happened all the time. You know, stuff. There was a guy in Huntington over there that locked himself in the booth till they pulled him out through the control room. They had to move the monitor out. But another funny story was Ralph Emery was the most famous radio personality that started at WTPR.
That's correct.
And Emery's a legend, always been a legend. And it would have been his 50th anniversary. So Ralph would have been in his 60s because he started as a kid. And he came back one day to Paris, and I was honored to get to engineer that show. But a few years before, there's something in the country music industry back then called fanfare. Mm-hmm. And all the artists would come out, and the fans would come visit them. But one day during fanfare was local radio day. The stations would go, and they'd park over there, and here'd come, you know, whoever it was, Dottie West, and then here'd come Ferlin Husky, and you get to do all these interviews. So the FM station was country, and this was Gary Pally, who's still the idol of most of us that came through that era over there, the late Gary Pally. And he begged them, and finally WTPR agreed to let him and a guy named Marshall Carter. Do you remember J. Marshall Carter?
A little bit, yeah.
Oh, J. Marshall Carter, WTPR. They let him go, and it was very coveted because everybody wanted the gig. So it was such a big deal in Paris. They have a lunch at the radio station. They cater it in. Here comes all the bankers and the county mayor and the president of the Chamber of Commerce to hear the Emory interview. Look how important we are. And man, this is the culmination of all these years of work. So Ralph's great. And Gary talks to him for a while and they do a little interview. And the whole thing lasts about 5 minutes. The entire community, the hierarchy of the communities in the talent studio in there. And Gary says, Ralph, just one more question, man. Why'd you leave WTPR? Emory goes, well, Gary, it was hard to make a living on 35 cents an hour. And Pally goes, Ralph, it still is. We'll be back in a moment. And everybody was making fun of the station manager and stuff, but that was a highlight to me.
Oh.
And the last one at WMUF. WMUF is in a marsh out there on the outskirts of Paris. And many people don't know broadcast radio. You see the antenna going up into the air, but a much bigger antenna is in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
There's coils of wire that go out for hundreds of feet or yards, and that's really your ground coil for the transmitter. And the better that ground coil, and in certain kinds of soil conditions, especially marshy ones, it just sends that signal out strong and forever.
Mm-hmm.
So we get ready to go on the air, and Cindy Snyder and I did mornings for a couple years at WMUF, and we were one of the stations that had to sign off at sunset. We couldn't broadcast at night because of WCFL. That was the clear channel station on the same frequency. So we couldn't, you know, at nighttime, your signal goes further. So WTPR AM, WMUF, we had to shut the thing off at night and turn it on at sunset the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd sign it on at 6 o'clock. And it was a great little station, best equipment anybody had in the air, but it was in a double-wide trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And the transmitter's in there, and the transmitter gets really hot. And so they forgot to insulate the pipes.
Ooh.
And at night, it was in a marsh, snakes would coil up on those pipes every night. We turned that thing on the next morning, and probably once a month, there'd be a big snake in there. One day, I picked up the newspaper. There, it was just snaky, period. Got in the morning, unfolded it, and the snake crawled out of the thing. So so I ended up doing the news always with my feet in the chair. But, yeah, that's probably my biggest memory of WMUF. We started with Carly Simon, and it was snaky as hell over there.
Oh, I never heard that one, man. I never heard about
that. Well,
the
they insulated it finally because Cindy and I go, we're not doing this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They had to pay somebody to get up there, and then they left one big hole, but I think they finally got it all fixed.
Man. Oh, man. Small town radio sometimes, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Bart, you went on, and part of your career, you got involved in the political aspect of press,
right,
and all that. How did that come about? I mean, you said you did news, but working for the governor of Tennessee, Ned McWhorter, had to be a big step for you.
Well, it was big and completely unexpected.
Uh-huh.
So our state representative there, I owe pretty much my entire professional life to Don and Mary Kate Ridgway.
Mm-hmm.
Mary Kate Ridgway was a local 4-H leader. She encouraged me to get into public speaking, which is really what led to the radio job and a lot of other opportunities. And Don was the state representative from Paris. He represented us in the Tennessee House of Representatives. So he calls me one day and said, McWhorter's running for governor. And I said, I thought he would. And they've done a commercial for him, and he hates it. So can you meet me out at Byron's at 6 o'clock tonight?
Mm-hmm.
Byron ended up becoming, or was, but that was Byron Gallimore, who became Tim McGraw's producer for his entire career.
Okay.
Big hit songwriter, produces a lot of folks. So Byron had written the track, the music, to a commercial called, I did the script, it was called He Knows the Way, the Tennessee Way. I never worked harder on anything in my life. I remember this exactly because they started counting them. I did 83 takes of that commercial.
Wow.
And we put it to bed about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and Ridgway left with a copy of it. And the very next day, McWhorter is doing a campaign drive-through in Henry County. and somebody sticks that into the cassette, into the tape player. And Ned flipped over it. And he said, who did that? He said, Bart did it. Bart and Byron did it. And I knew McWhorter. He'd been our state representative. He was my grandfather's mailman.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sorry, my grandfather was his mailman. Mm-hmm. And so I'm doing a live interview on the campaign stop. We take a break. They're having a fish fry. There's probably 4,000 people in the old Midway Auto Auction parking lot. And we'll be right back after this. We go to commercial, and McWhorter, he always called me Barto. He goes, Barto? I said, yes, Speaker, because he was the Speaker of the House before he was the governor. I'm going to be the next governor of Tennessee. I said, well, I believe that you are. He said, will you come do press for me?
Wow. Like,
What? And then a couple of elderly ladies walked up. We went back and finished the interview, and then he said, I want you to come to work with me. I said, okay, I will. And we ran into him a few more times on the campaign trail, Ridgway and I, but I got disappointed because it never came up again, even when Don tried to talk about it. We go to his swearing in. I'll remember this. I took my mother to the inaugural ball. I was so sick with the flu. Come back, I'm on the air the next day. I think that was like a Friday morning. And Eva Morris, this lady was our receptionist. I was on the air. There was a big red light bulb that showed, or white light bulb, then that showed you're on the air. You can't walk in when we're on the air. Eva runs in. I'm in the middle of a newscast, and she's like, Bart. I said, we'll be right back. I'm like, Eva, I'm on the air. She goes, Governor McWhorter's on the phone. And he said, can you be up here tomorrow? So I think it was a Thursday. I said, no, sir, but I'll be there Monday. And they had a big goodbye celebration, and I became the deputy director of communications for the state of Tennessee.
Wow.
And a couple of years later, the U.S. congressman from Nashville stopped by the governor's office. He needed some press help. His name was Bob Clement from a legacy Tennessee political family. And I helped him out, and Bob offered me a job. And I didn't take it initially, but some developments occurred, wasn't long, maybe a month or two later, he asked me again, I'll become your press secretary on one condition. I get to do the music issues. He said, Bart, we've got legislative aides that do that. And when I said, look, then I'm just not interested. He said, okay, do them. I grew up in Paris, a guy from Camden, but he lived in Paris, with a great songwriter, a great front man for the band Tennessee River Crooks,
T.R. Crooks.
Oh,
I remember
Crooks.
Those. Yeah, I remember
His
those
His name
guys.
Was Jimmy Stewart. Jimmy went on to become a very famous songwriter. He wrote Brotherly Love, A Little Less Talk for Toby Keith, a bunch of monster hit songs. And because of Jimmy, I love the songs. I love the words. I did anyway, in the lyrics, but I was always interested in songwriting. And I read the liner notes, who played bass and all that, but I wanted to know who wrote the songs.
Right.
And so Bob said yes. I go to D.C. in sometime in 87. And my very first week, because I'm doing the music issues, there's a scheduled meeting with NSAI, the Nashville Songwriters Association International. So I sit down with a publisher named Kevin Lamb and a great songwriter named Peter McCann. Peter had a big disco hit where he wrote it. He was the artist. Do you remember, do you want to make love,
yeah,
or do you just want to fool around? That was Peter.
Went
on to write Right Time of the Night. It must have been the worst meeting in NSAI history because I didn't hear a word they said. I kept going, y'all do what? You're a songwriters association? I said a prayer after that meeting that day, and I said, Lord, I want that to be my life's calling after this. Hmm. 10 years later, I applied for the job. That was 25 years ago that I became the executive director of the Nashville Songwriters Association. So
wow.
That was my career path.
Thanks for checking us out on today's edition of Radio Guy Reflections. We'll have more with Bart Herbison coming up after this. Hi, this is Dave Denton. Let my voice go to work for you. It's davesvoiceworks.com. Spell works, W-O-R-X. And you can hear samples of my on-air work and also some of the commercials I've done over the years. There's pictures from some of my career and more, all at daysvoiceworks.com. daysvoiceworks.com, spell works, W-O-R-X. Reflections.
Too many people in this business who think that they're, I guess it's a podcast, their stuff doesn't stink. You know, it's just like, hey, look, we're all just enjoying the game. We're all just having a good time. Sports are supposed to be fun. Don't take yourself too seriously. Let's go have a good time and really paint a great picture for the fans out there.
I wanted to be me. I didn't want to put on a show. I wanted to, obviously, a show, but I didn't want to be fake on the air. What you get is what you get.
You know, that would be a fascinating career. I want to witness history in a way and see it and tell the compelling stories of it.
When did you find out he is autistic?
When you get that diagnosis, it's not necessarily a shock to you, but it's validating how you've been feeling.
I can't imagine what the future of talk radio could have been or would have been had Rush not come along when he did.
This is Radio Guy Reflections. Well, I remember you playing Tennessee River Crooks on the air and playing it for me. And I just remember that what a great sound that band had. And I wonder what happened to him. And actually, Bart, I brought this up. I was doing an interview, and I want to say his name was Phelps. He was a member of the Kentucky Headhunters. And I was talking to them, and I thought they sounded so much like T.R. Crooks.
Yeah, Ricky Phelps. Yeah,
Ricky
he's a great
Phelps.
Guy. Yeah,
and,
that's
I,
right.
And I asked him if they were ever part of T.R. Crooks, because I remember they sounded so much alike. And when you brought that up, man, that brought back some memories, because that was a great local band, T.R. Crooks.
Well, here's another story locally, but I think people appreciate this. I get asked every day what my favorite song is. My favorite song is the Rain song by Led Zeppelin.
Uh-huh.
But then I say, you should ask that differently. And they'll go, what should I ask? And I'll go, what's the most important song I ever heard? So they ask me that. And I say, it's by T.R. Crooks. It's the Song of David. So in West Tennessee, back when we were going up, we followed bands. There was Windows. There was T.R. Crooks. There were a couple other great area bands. And every weekend we were in Martin, Murray, Paris, Dyersburg, somewhere. And I was a T.R. Crooks guy, Jimmy's best friend. So wherever they played, Metropolis, Illinois, Dyersburg, Waverly, I was there. Mm-hmm. And so was a guy named David Puckett. And by the way, so were 300 or 400 other friends. We had a reunion right before I left Paris in 85 or 86 at the Midway Auto Auction. We sold 4,500 tickets. The entire population of the town was only 9,000.
Wow.
And people kept coming. It's the only time they had to shut down Highway 79 and do a detour. And they tore the gate down. I estimated about 7,000 people came to see that band, and they hadn't played in 15 years.
Wow.
So if that tells you something. But one of the posse was a guy named David Puckett. And David was an artist. And he drew the album covers and the posters. And sadly, David, in his early 20s, he was attending UT Martin, passed away. Hmm. His parents were older, and he was the only child. They weren't going to have any more kids. They were productive members of society, but they didn't mow the yard. Trash was out. They both quit their jobs. You'd see him maybe every once in a while in a house coat, and they couldn't grieve. They just didn't get over it.
Oh.
So several months passed, and Jimmy had written a song about it to pay tribute to David Puckett called Song of David. And they were playing there locally one night, and a bunch of kids, basically they kidnapped them. They went to get them to come to the show, and they weren't going to come, and they made them come. Wherever the venue is, everywhere the Crooks were, it was always packed to the rafters, beyond fire code. So wherever it was there in Paris, a few hundred people, and they play Song of David. I'll sing the Song of David, and I'll sing it loud. To share his friendship sure did make me proud. You know I'll miss him till the end of time. Brother David was a friend of mine. And it celebrates his paintings and all this. And that night, they were crying like babies. 300 or 400 cigarette lighters are held up in the air, and every kid in Paris is singing that song. Mm. And you could see their faces change. They cried, but then they smiled. Every person in that room, they stayed for hours talking about what David meant to them. And a couple weeks later, I passed by and they mowed their yard. Oh. Music is powerful, and it let them grieve over their son. And Jimmy inspired me. That song inspired me. I've been so blessed. That's a local story, but it's the power of songs, David. It's the power of songs.
And those songs and those lyrics, and then when you add the music itself to it, it touches something inside each and every one of us. And sometimes it's in different ways. I mean, you talked about the Song of David and how it touched you and how it affected your life. And it affected these parents so much. And I agree with you. The power of music and song is something that we that have done radio in the past have seen it happen so many times. When someone calls you when you're on the air and they maybe have lost a friend for whatever reason, and they want to hear a certain song because it means so much. And kind of a comical twist on this was I was working at WYNK in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and on Saturday nights we did an all-request show. And this all-request show would always get calls from Angola, the very famous prison in Louisiana. I mean, it's the prison in the South and one of the most notorious prisons in the country.
I think they found a lot of bodies buried out there, literally. What's that movie that's patterned after Angola down there? One of them is. So.
Yeah. Well, this every Saturday night, and I didn't get to do this show every Saturday night, but I did it several times. And they told me, said, watch out for this one call. Someone would call from Angola, one of the prisoners, and he would want to hear Mama Tried by Merle Haggard. Mm-hmm. And he would break down crying every time because he loved his mother so much and he had gotten himself into so much trouble that he was a lifer at Angola, and he wanted to let people know to listen to their mamas. And that story has stuck with me for years, and I actually got to talk to him a couple of times, and you could hear the real passion in his voice for that particular song. And songs like Curtis Lowe by Lynyrd Skynyrd and Freebird, and then Simple Man by Charlie Daniels, and then you get into some of the old Motown songs that mean so much to me. I agree with you. The power of music and song can affect us in so many different ways.
Absolutely. And I'm so privileged to direct the world's largest songwriters association, man. It's really come full circle for me.
Okay. Give us the complete name of this association, and I want to talk to you about what you guys do.
Well, I'll answer both of those questions.
Okay.
It's the Nashville Songwriters Association International, NSAI. The International shouldn't probably have been there. That was a decision made years ago because we got chapters around the world. But I looked into dropping the I and understanding that was going to cost about $250,000 to change all the paperwork. But here's the story. 1967, there's a total of 80 songwriters in the entire town. 80. We were the idea of a man named Eddie Miller. Eddie wrote the great country standard, Please Release Me, Let Me Go.
Oh, a great song.
Eddie convinced 41 others to form the Nashville Songwriters Association as an advocacy group for the profession. I'm going to pick that up in a minute. We're going to go way back to 1909. Edison Records Sound, and America had a cobbled together, some of it from the Queen Anne version of copyright law in England in the 1600s. And it certainly was antiquated and didn't contemplate now music is recorded. So they wrote the modern American copyright law. Parts of it, sadly, we're still under. And stay with me here. We're going to get in the weeds.
Okay.
When somebody listens to a song, they hear two copyrights. There's the song that the songwriter writes. So for Taylor Swift, we'll call it Red. That's under a very unfriendly set of rules. For the songwriter, number one, the government sets our rate. Seriously, they don't set the record label's rate. And that's the second copyright, the song that Taylor records or whoever records a copy of Red. Ryan Adams recorded it under a much more friendly set of rules because they get to negotiate. streaming services want to play that song, they have to say yes. And because of that, when streaming started, the record label side made 1,700% more than the songwriters.
Wow.
We've changed that. We're working on it, but it's just unfair. There's only one place we get to negotiate in the free market. That's for synchronization, for video, for film, TV, commercials. And since Talking Pictures for 100 years, the song gets half, the record gets half. But the second thing that happened in 1909 is the rules were ridiculous. And it said you can only pay that songwriter so little, not so much, so little, that the purchaser of what's called a mechanical player piano roll won't notice a price increase. And that royalty is now called a mechanical royalty or a sales royalty. And the songwriter's got a penny. Now let's put this on trial for a minute. Some of these wax cylinders Edison had invented were selling for $5, $6, $7, $8, $9. They were a rich person's novelty. We got a penny. When I say we got a penny, let's suppose three songwriters composed that song together and they've each got a publisher. They each got 1/6 of a penny. Mm-hmm. And we didn't get a pay raise until 1978 to 2 cents. And the final rule that happened in 1909 is horrible. It's something called a compulsory license. Once we agree to let somebody record that song, anybody in history that follows that can record it without our permission for those same stupid low government rates. So the songwriters are oppressed. They're under all these restrictions that the record labels are not under. And we've been clawing and scratching, especially in the modern era, and it's been tough. Most of the songwriters don't do it anymore. You know, they don't start off doing it for money, but I'll tell you a sad joke. You know, how do you get a songwriter off your front porch?
How do you get a songwriter off your front porch?
You pay him for the pizza. And the other joke is, what's the difference between a songwriter and a pizza?
I don't know. What's the difference between a songwriter and a pizza?
We've still got it, don't we? The difference is, David, a pizza will feed a family of four. And while those are jokes that we tell in the industry, sadly, they're true.
Right.
You can get your song can be spun 35 million times. And if it's a four-way split with two writers and two publishers, you make less than $500.
Wow.
Now, for broadcast radio, you make a lot more money because it's a mass consumption thing. But we've been struggling. We're finally winning some trials, having some legislation that's getting us closer. But there has to be a value to music. I'm going to go back and preach a little bit here.
Okay.
When our founding fathers wrote the Constitution, they all knew that America, its promise, was its ideas. And they all believed that. They were all authors, inventors. I mean, you look at Washington, Franklin, Adams. But there was one in particular who was so eloquent and spoke on it so well that Washington himself asked him to write Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution. And that was James Madison. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get the copyright. In order to promote progress in science and the useful arts, Congress may grant for a limited time to authors and inventors. They knew this had a value. Mm-hmm. But somehow, a few years back, with the creation of the internet, we've got a couple generations that just don't value music and feel like it's okay to steal it. Mm-hmm. And so it's been a constant struggle that we're fighting, but it goes back to 1909. We're making some progress. Mm-hmm. We've had some victories recently, but that's how we got into this mess to begin with. Goes all the way back. We had record labels then, RCA, Victrola. And look, we're really working with the record labels. I don't mean this to be some discourse against them. We're working with them in a much more equitable way than we ever had. And it seems promising to find a fair recalibration of this in the future. But back then it was Thomas Edison, RCA Victrola. They're up there lobbying for this. One guy goes to represent songwriters, John Philip Sousa, mm-hmm. that John Philip Sousa, and he couldn't even really get many appointments. So we got put under some of the craziest, most onerous rules that we're still trying to extricate ourselves from.
Wow. Well, you know, Bart, that kind of reminds me. I'm a big comic book guy. I love comic books and superhero movies. And mm-hmm. a very similar story happened in the comic book industry and superhero industry with the creators of Batman and Superman.
And I'm involved in that court case. We filed a friend of the court brief. And I know the family very well with it against Schuster, yeah.
So, yeah, and then there, that the artist and the writer named Neil Adams was one that really brought that to the forefront. And I had an opportunity to meet Mr. Adams, who passed away last year. And he made it where the families were getting some of the residuals from the movies and all the cartoon series and the current comic books that are out there. So you're kind of operating under those same type of auspices, trying to get right. these creators the recognition and the money they deserve.
Well, it's intellectual property. It's uh-huh. property.
Right.
You know, and I've had some unfriendly members of Congress go, well, whatever, what about your biography? Well, what's the difference? It's right. in your mind. And now it's digital. It's online. Why can't I just go get a free copy? You know, there's a couple of common misperceptions. A lot of artists do write songs. And, you know, I'm sure Garth Brooks doesn't need the money.
Right.
And they get to sell merch. They get to sell concert tickets. It's the only source of income for the co-writer, for Kent Blazy, for Pat Alger, for Tony Arata, who wrote the dance for Garth, and those other two wrote songs with Garth. Mm-hmm. And Garth's been a huge ally in helping us trying to change these things. But the point is, it didn't happen overnight. Most songwriters spend 20 years before they ever see a penny. They're right. the weird person in school. That's that songwriter girl, or that's that songwriter guy. And
right.
they make it. And I'll tell you something. If you're a true artist or songwriter, it's not something you got up one day, Dave, and said, oh, I want to do this. You're born with it.
Right.
And it will drive you batty insane. It keeps calling on you, and it's just part of your DNA. Mm-hmm. And so then the next step that happens is doctor, lawyer, what are you going to be in college? Well, I'm not going to college. I'm moving to Nashville or LA or New York. And back then there were a lot more options, Shoals, Detroit, whatever. You're going to do what? And after an intervention and your family cuts you off, you go to one of those towns. You were awesome in your hometown, but you go to the Bluebird Cafe, which we own, by the way, right. or some other great spot where the songwriters are, and you go, oh my God. And you realize you're not ready. And you start writing with other people that come to town, praying that someday you'll get to write with Hillary Lindsay or, you know, somebody like that, Lee Miller. And you just have to work your way through it for years. You write better songs, you get exposed. In the commercial music industry, let me tell you how hard it is. There will be more new starters on the Tennessee Titans this fall than people that get new record deals with enough money behind them to make them work.
Right.
It is tough. It's hard. And it's always been hard. Mm-hmm. And harder for nobody than the songwriter. We own the trademark at NSAI. It all begins with the song. There's not a damn thing without that song. There's no music industry. There's no publishers. There's no record labels. And Congress, America, and consumers have forgotten that. Let me throw it out this way. Do you remember, there used to be a little music store around from WTPR called Leach's Music.
Yep.
Leach's Music and TV. Sellers, Bob, Leach over there. And when CDs first came out, we had a sponsorship with Leach's. Up next, the Stones, Miss You on a crystal clear Leach's Music compact disc. Those things cost $20. A CD when they first came out were $19.99.
Right.
Now let's put this in perspective. You can get a subscription for $9.99 a month and get the entire history of recorded music straight to you.
Right.
It's undervalued and people ought to appreciate it. You go to get a lunch at Taco Bell, I can spend $14 or $15. So I am preaching to your whole audience, let's value music, especially the songwriters. If we don't, it's going to be another thing America used to be the best at. And we got to take care of the songwriters.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a change that I wanted to talk to you about also with how corporations have kind of taken over the music industry, not only just radio, but in the music industry. And then where you're at in Nashville, Tennessee, there's been a lot of controversy and a lot of criticism about how corporations have kind of taken country music and made it too formulaic. I can't speak
right
here. Too many formulas to write write a hit song. And you know, I worked in country music. I've worked pop music, classic hits, classic rock. I've worked all kinds of different formats, but I especially noticed in country music in the early to mid 90s, a big change in the way country music sounded. It's more popish now. I remember I even did not play some Shania Twain songs because I didn't think they were country at the time. I mean, I just was like, where's the Willie Nelsons? Where's the Merle Haggards? Where's the Johnny Cash? The sound just was not the same. Have you ran into having problems with some of the corporations in the music industry?
Well, I think it's not an inaccurate observation, but there's more to it than that.
Okay.
Corporations have always run the music industry.
Right.
Always. Always, from day one. You know, the big end of the commercial music industry, because it's not cheap.
Right.
To take a country single to number one is somewhere around $2 million. You can double or triple that in pop. You know, that's a lot of that goes to radio promotion. It is what it is. But let me try to give you we could talk about this for hours, but I'll break it down quickly.
Okay.
It's all about whoever, essentially these corporations are banks and distributors and logistics folks that put you out on tour. For years and years and years, it was all about live music, really until about the late 50s, early 60s.
Right.
You can go from Mary Had a Little Lamb to Caruso to Guy Lombardo to Sinatra. But somewhere between Sinatra and Elvis, it became about selling albums, not just singles, but albums. And we got this spoiled period from the 60s, 70s, 80s into the early 90s. Where from the songwriters, for instance, you didn't even have to have a big radio single. You just needed to cut on that triple million selling Garth Brooks album, and you got some royalties for that.
Right.
But what happened, the first thing that hurt us was piracy. And so piracy ended up, it's hard to fight free, Dave. It's still, and there's piracy still a big problem.
Right.
Then after piracy, when we finally get a little bit of a handle on that, here comes the streaming companies under rules from 1909 that are unfair. And, you know, the label side gets most of the money. So we went from about 4,000 or 5,000 songwriters in Nashville with publishing deals, making a nice middle income living, you know, when I first got there in the late 90s, to eventually down to about 400 songwriters. Mm. It's rebounded. My guesstimate is we're somewhere around 1,500 or whatever. But speaking to your what you said earlier specifically, I sat down with one of the three top record label heads in Nashville a few years ago, and I'm like, every one of these guys looks exactly the same. They sound exactly the same. What is this bro country stuff? While you're not doing great songs. He said, Bart, we lose money on putting out records. You think about this for a minute. They're finally starting to earn money on streaming. In the early days, putting out a record lost money because the labels don't get money from radio.
Right.
They only get it from streaming. And so they were losing money, and it shifted. It all went from record sales. An artist, I'm not being succinct. Let me start over and put it this way. In the old days, an artist recouped. They only made money from record sales. They got an advance from the label. They didn't sell records. They never had to pay it back. They were selling physical products. That was the record business. But sometime with the internet, late 90s, early 2000s, we went from piracy and all these LimeWire and all these sites where you could just rip songs to streaming, which I still say sometimes ought to be illegal because it's legalized piracy for the songwriter. And then it shifted.
Mm-hmm.
the money equation at the labels went from selling records to live shows. The contracts change. An artist's contract no longer said you pay us back out of record sales. It said you pay us out of a 360 deal, the entire circle of your income, merch, ticket sales, product endorsements. So it all became about who was going to the concerts. And this record label head told me 70% of our audience is 19 to 26-year-old females. Hmm. It's not about songs. It's about this drinking, partying lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And that was what Bro Country reflected. Hmm. We're still not completely out of it. They are still chasing what people respond to at live concerts because there's no money on the sales side. Hmm. That's one part of it. Number two, I just find that genres get stale a little bit and then they have a resurrection. If I'm right, what I'm hearing that you haven't heard yet that's about to come out on radio, it's really good music and it's songs again. It's some story songs and some labels. They're still going to do the live concert stuff, but they understand they need more than that because we're losing our radio audience. Mm-hmm. And part of this, David's generational. You know, a lot of it I don't like, but my staff who's young, they do. So mm-hmm. I don't think it's one thing. It's all those things put together. And we're still in one of the biggest transitions ever, man. Mm-hmm. We're going from an analog to a digital age. Let me put it this way. That phone we're both holding just turned 11 next month.
Right.
So we're still trying to figure all this out, mm-hmm. including what the music is. The good news is there are a lot more great choices online. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm finding some great stuff on there that I would have never found probably on commercial radio. And I think we need both, David. We really do. We need radio to serve the public. I hope they keep putting them in cars. And then we need the option of the mass consumption the internet gives us. Mm-hmm.
So I was going to ask you this, and I think when we were setting up this interview, I said I was going to ask you this. With your organization that is basically for the songwriters, what is your connection and what do you think is going on between like the songwriters and the radio industry? What can radio do differently to help out the songwriters and your organization?
Well, I've had the highest level meetings with record labels I've had in my 25-year career and some other trade associations because there's some disturbing statistics in over-the-air radio, disturbing. Mm-hmm. We're trying to figure out how to attack that. You know, when you ask me about the future of the industry, the advocacy, how everything gets paid, how we're trying to change old rules into a new way that music's distributed, there's no short answer, but I'll try to be succinct.
Okay.
You have to take the artists and record labels first. They are fighting hard, radio, for a performance royalty like songwriters get. Mm-hmm. Back in the 30s, when radio emerged, the record labels, I think they'd say they've made a mistake, that they've been trying to change ever since. They didn't try to get a royalty from radio, this new thing, because they thought, just play our stuff and we'll sell a bunch of albums. And it worked for a while.
Right.
That certainly doesn't work anymore. So that's adversarial. That's really a battle line drawn in Washington between radio and the artist and record labels. Mm-hmm. You won't see many of the actual artists getting involved in it because they need to get out and make a living. And so our association, while we have songwriters who are also artists, we don't claim to represent the artist. There are other organizations that do that on the label side. So I'm working on a broader dialogue. On the one hand, if you ask me, I do think those artists deserve a royalty, A. B, I don't think it should come out of the songwriter side. But C, radio's bleeding, especially country radio.
Right.
So I'm not sure we can apply any of these old models to our future. There are conversations about, you know, radio. Most radio stations are also in the streaming business. They're having discussions about maybe there's a way to look at all that together and give a break on one side. look, here's the way we've solved problems for 25 years. And if you Google my name and NSAI, you'll see we've particularly been on a roll the past few years. Mm-hmm. You got to sit down in the room together. You got to forget this Hatfield and McCoy thing we've been going through for years. And you got to start with the question, what does your industry look 10 years like 10 years down the road? What does our industry look like?
Right.
And how do we both profit together? And I'm starting to sense a little more of that, but there's tough problems because radio is going the way of newspaper. We're all victims to, you know, ones and zeros, to digital, and we weren't ready for it. I'll end with this about that topic. I started doing a mental exercise of this about a decade ago, and I went all the way back really to the start of humanity, but I went back to Gutenberg. And I studied him a lot. And I realized that everything that followed for the distribution of creativity, whether it's books, music, TV, whatever, there's three phases. The first phase is the new invention. So before Gutenberg, you've got to handwrite the Bible. You got to let the ink dry. You got to stack it over here in a corner. You got to come back and either try to write on the back of that page or just put double the pages you need. Then you got to bind it. And some human did that, and it takes 2 years. But here comes this thing called the printing press. And it changes it all. Here's phase one of the new way of doing things. It's something new. And what you've got to do is set that page in type, print 500 pages, stack them over in the corner, change the type to page two, but it's way more efficient. In that same 2 years, you can print 2,000 or 3,000 Bibles, phase one. Phase two, the new invention gets better. So now all of a sudden you've got a printing press. It's got a paper feeder, an inkjet. You can digitally set the type, and it staples the Bibles, and it spews out 2,000 a day. Phase three is everybody has that. So now who owns the rights to the Bible? And we're somewhere between two and three. Because all the companies that distribute music are now getting into the content end of it. Mm-hmm. The content creators are now getting into the distribution end of it. So I'm always optimistic that people will pay for things like music. We're seeing more of that than we used to. And I'm optimistic that we'll figure it out because the people that love music and other creations are going to demand it. But it's going to be different. It's going to be different. And ultimately, for the songwriters and artists, I hope we can become part of the ownership of the much bigger picture, probably along with radio.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bart, that I love that analogy that you just did because it takes that process and makes it very, very much where your mind can wrap around how technology has changed things in all of the industry, not just
the only difference is back then those would take eons, hundreds of years.
Right.
All this happened in the last 20. It's a different time, man.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating, but it's equally exciting, David.
So. Yeah. And then you talked about content and just recently getting out of the broadcast industry and doing what I do now with a couple of different podcasts where I talk about things. Content is the key, and the content for a songwriter is that mm-hmm. song. And then trying to get that song distributed is more content that maybe somebody else can supply, but you're trying to get these different suppliers, the supplier of the content, the talent that records it, the people that produce it, the people that publish it, trying to get them to all work together more as a team, aren't you?
Well, I have a small role in that. We mm-hmm. all are.
Right.
But it just evolves that way, and it's evolving that way.
Right.
You know? Some of the streaming services now are becoming publishers and record labels, and some of the labels have their own streaming service, and it will all find its way. Mm-hmm. We just happen for creators to be in a really frustrating time. I'm Tim Nichols, who besides Jimmy Stewart was the first songwriter I ever met in Nashville in the mid-80s because they wrote the great Keith Whitley, Earl Thomas, Conley duet called Brotherly Love.
Oh, great song.
It's about Jimmy's late brother, Ricky. And, Jimmy. And you know, Tim was part of that early story I told you. He lived somewhere. He was the crazy songwriter guy, and he moved down. His family had an intervention, starved to death, and he kind of made it. But he came under a set of rules that said, you go get a publishing deal, you pitch songs to the artist, there's all these record labels, and they get played on the radio, and they sell, and I make money. So imagine all this changing when you have no other career option. And the biggest thing that's broken my heart is to see great American songwriters who can't make a living on it anymore and really don't have any other career path because they came and the rules changed in the middle of it. And so we'll figure it out, but it's been, there's a lot of debris in our rearview mirror, pal. A lot of human debris. So,
well, you also mentioned just a few minutes ago about the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville, a very famous live music venue, and you have ownership of that, you and your company. Is that right? How did that come about?
A lady named Amy Kerwin opened this place in 1982.
Right.
She wanted a place for healthier lunches. You know, everything up here is fried. So, and that didn't really work out. And she tried a few different things, and it didn't really work out. And one night she had a songwriter night, and they were lined up Hillsborough Road. And not too many months later, there was one every night and two every night. And then so many young writers coming to town wanted to play it. Amy created this audition process. And there was nothing like this in the world. So publishers and record labels got smart. Instead of driving all over the country, and this is pre-internet, to find talent or spending millions and millions of dollars, why don't we just run over to the Bluebird and people start getting discovered? You know, in the 80s and 90s, virtually every songwriter in town had some intersection with the Bluebird, but so did artists. Everybody from Kathy Mattea to Taylor Swift to Garth got discovered there. Mm-hmm. It's very small, 99 seats. It's almost more like attending a play than a musical event. You can't talk there or we'll go, shh. We don't let you talk during songs. And we all have to do that. Because as much of the feeling in the Bluebird is the stories and the interactions of the songwriters. It's like the story I told you about, you know, Song of David. And they talk about how it was written. Usually the four writers, it's in the round. This person plays the song, then the person to their right, and they just go around in the round. They play on each other's song. It's very, very personal. And so Amy had done it for a long time. And one of the first employees she had who was waiting tables over there was a lady named Erica Wallum Nichols, who I was fortunate enough. She was on the staff at NSAI when I became the director. We've worked together on and off for years. And one day in 2000, let me get the year wrong, in the mid-2000s, I want to say it was like early mid-07, Amy came to us and goes, y'all want the Bluebird. And she essentially gave it to us, I think because she knew we'd protect the reverence of it, and we have.
Right.
So Erica left NSAI. She's the general manager of the Bluebird. And then the show Nashville happened, and it's crazy town over there, man. Crazy. I'll tell you, it's a pretty day in Nashville. There's probably 700 tourists standing in front of it right now taking pictures.
Mm. Well, I remember I took a trip to Nashville. I want to say it was around 1990. And it was part of a radio station promotion with a bus tour that we went to Nashville with. And this was around 1990, and I remember everyone talking about the Bluebird. I didn't get to go to that, but at that time they were all saying that's where Randy Travis got his start. And that's where I became familiar with the Bluebird. And when I was looking at your bio and some of your on-air stuff and I saw that you had the Bluebird, I went, wow. I mean, I said, wow, this is really cool because this is a venue that has seen so many talented people come through. And just to know that you've had a little bit to do with it, man, that is just nothing but cool. I got to commend you on that.
Well, I got to shamelessly self-promote. On Amazon right now, we're apparently we're in the movie business now. There's Bluebird, the movie. Cool. Free on Amazon. Go watch it. It's going to blow your mind.
Uh-huh.
Look, a little story on that. Erica showed me the first cut, and I didn't get to watch it for a couple nights. It's late. I'm up in the office one Thursday night. I'll never forget it. I watched it, and I cried like a baby and laughed like I was at a comedy concert. Because some of the most important moments of my life happened at the Bluebird and another similar venue in Nashville, sadly, that's now closed, called Douglas Corner.
Uh-huh.
So Erica went through a few more versions of it, and I told her this, so if she hears the podcast, she knows this. Every one of them was worse. And I asked her one day, so-and-so thinks we should do this and think we should do that. Brian LaShavio is the director on it. And she said, what do you think? Or I said, maybe I told her, I'm going to give you an unsolicited opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Need to go back and watch that first version of it. You and Brian need to lock yourself in somewhere, get some Mountain Dew and some Hot Pockets for days. You two edit it and forget everything anybody's told you about it, including me.
Mm-hmm.
And you will look at what they came out with. She showed me that last version. I saw it actually at a film festival. Go see it, man. I'm so proud of this. I had nothing to do with it. It's all Erica.
Wow.
Second movie that I am an associate producer on. I'm so proud of this. It's called It All Begins With the Song. Also on Amazon. Butch Spiridon, who runs the Nashville Convention and Visitors Corporation, that was his vision. I'm glad he let me work with him on this. It is so amazing. And then we shot a movie at NSAI called Wheeler, W-H-E-E-L-E-R, and I get to play myself. And it's about this older writer from Kaufman, Texas, named Wheeler Bryson. And I'm going to spoiler alert, this all happens right up front. His father passes away.
Mm-hmm.
And Wheeler's a country songwriter, singer down there, who had a dream earlier in his life of coming to Nashville and making it. But something happened and he didn't get the chance. But after his father dies, he decides to come. And I'll stop there. And NSAI is a huge part of this movie. I think Dorf deserved an Oscar for it. One little side note, he's wearing some prosthetic makeup in this thing. You can't really recognize it's Stephen Dorff.
Mm.
We do two or three shows at the Bluebird. We go do this interview at WSM. His father and his late brother, Andrew, are both, they're some of America's greatest songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knew the studio guys. We walked in and cut some songs as Wheeler. Nobody knew who it was. We got away with it. We pulled this thing off. Just watch it and then read about it. And it's one of the proudest things I've ever been involved in. And they're all on Amazon right now. So
that is so cool, Bart. And the Bluebird is still going. And it's a real growing thing for tourism in Nashville, is it not?
It is. You know, we get complaints from the locals because it's hard to get in. And people always call me for tickets. I literally do not have a single ticket. We allot a generous allotment to the performers, and we can only help somebody if the performers don't use all their tickets.
Wow.
Treat everybody the same. Everybody gets online. You got to do it that way. And even when I go to the Bluebird, even though, you know, I run the organization that owns it, I stand in that line outside, and I should, because it's part of the reverence of the history of the Bluebird Cafe.
Wow. Now, Nashville is such a great music town, and I think a lot of people, a little misconception about Nashville, it's only country music, but man, they've got all kinds of talent there, from the rock and roll era to hip-hop artists and everything. That is just one great music town, isn't it?
Well, the music industry devolved. You know, when I came on board, Chicago, Miami, Detroit, Shoals, I can name a half dozen other towns. Cleveland had some stuff. You know, there were all legitimate music components there. Right. Down in Austin. Austin doesn't have a publisher. They don't have anything. BMI finally came back and opened an office up. And New York was really one of the creative hubs, but it's become more of the administration of music.
Right.
The two, if you like the top end of commercial music, that all lives in two places, Los Angeles and Nashville. And, you know, we have a lot of rock and pop, and we don't have that much hip hop in Nashville. We've got some.
Right.
You know, LA doesn't have as much country and not much Christian, but they're the same companies.
Right.
So we all know each other. We're all under the same umbrella. And if you want to be in the commercial industry and be a hit songwriter or artist, you got to end up there at some point, one of those two towns.
I just remember when I came to Nashville and, you know, being from Memphis and you know, the music scene there. Well, the few times that I've been to Nashville, one of the things that I really enjoyed was the live music scene. I remember late at night, one night when I was there, I found out about a radio show they were doing on WSM. It was from Ernest Tubbs Record Store.
Record shop, man. They quit that during the pandemic, and I hated that.
That was so much fun and so, good.
At midnight.
Oh, yeah, and I stayed the whole time. I mean, you couldn't get me away from there. I think I went twice. While I was in Nashville.
Yeah.
It was just so much fun. Well, Bart, I don't want to take up all your time because I know you're a busy man. I am just I'm just flabbergasted and also very proud to say that I got to know you.
One more thing before we go.
Yeah.
You're in Utah, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, we lost a man I love. We became close personal friends. We did a thing shortly before he passed away, and he said, Bart, you're a royal pain in the ass. And everybody laughed, and he goes, but that's what it takes to get things done in Washington.
Right.
And that's the late Utah Senator Orrin Hatch.
Oh, what a great man.
One of the best men I've ever known.
Right.
I'm going to tell you a story I never told anybody about Senator Hatch.
Okay.
So I get this job, and I'd worked on the Hill for 10 years, and I'd met Senator Hatch, but I didn't know him, and I don't think he really knew me. Our very first trip to Washington, and I need to impress my board and my new constituent songwriters, and the guy, one of the two or three guys, has always been Senator Hatch, because he was a songwriter.
Right.
He was a legitimate songwriter, and he knew our plight and wrote songs with some of them, so I needed him to remember my name. It was that simple. It was our biggest appointment, and I needed him to go, Bart. And it was sort of to impress my new, you know, constituents. So, weirdly, I don't know that it ever happened the way Congress works today. I get in to see him the day before everybody else comes. I'm like, how can I get him to remember my name? Do I do the George Cassandra? Bart says, hello, Senator. Bart's doing really good. It's been a long time since Bart seen you. I thought that'd be stupid.
Uh-huh.
And it was breakfast time, and I always have a giant glass of OJ. I have like this 24-ounce glass of orange juice. He bends over for a second, and I poured it all down the front of myself in my suit. And he turns around and goes, oh, my God. And he gets towels, and he goes, Bart, what are we going to do? Y'all help Bart get a towel. And I sacrificed my clothing, and the next day we came in there, he goes, hey, OJ boy. Bart spilled orange juice all over himself yesterday.
Wow.
And that's really how we kind of got started, and we had an amazing relationship. And I miss him a lot. I seriously, seriously miss him. Because one of our biggest accomplishments, that crazy copyright law from 1909, we still need to make a lot of changes. But in 2018, we made the most substantive changes for songwriters in over 100 years. It's called the Music Modernization Act. Excuse me, the Orrin Hatch Music Modernization Act.
So cool.
All the folks in Utah, love him, and let's remember that.
Well, you know, he wrote a lot of songs that Gladys Knight recorded on some of her albums, and he was a wonderful man, but also a very good songwriter on the side there. But what he did for the nation as a whole in Utah, I don't know if we'll ever really understand what an important man he was as far as what has happened politically in the last 25 years.
You know, his faith was Mormon, and he loved Utah, and I was with him a lot. I mean, a lot.
Uh-huh.
And he always talked about that. There were always a bunch of constituents in the lobby, and he loved where he came from, and we're going to miss him. It's, you know, we have a lot of politicians, but he's somebody that governed.
Right. And he was a good man. I had a chance to meet him a couple of times when he came through Logan, And I did one little story about Senator Hatch. One day when my wife couldn't have lunch with me, I went to a local restaurant that was a buffet called Chuck-O-Rama here in Utah, and I served myself, and then all of a sudden right next to me is Senator Hatch. And he was serving himself. I'm sitting there. Here's a U.S. senator who is taking it upon himself not to say to one of his flackies, hey, go get me some fried chicken, you know, and that was just the kind of man he was, and I was very impressed with him as a person.
Well, and until he left office, he was third in line for the presidency.
Right,
so
right.
This is for you, Senator Hatch.
Oh, that's an awesome story, Bart. I appreciate that. Bart, I want to tell you once again how much I appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk to us. I started this podcast just over a year and a half ago just because I wanted to talk to people about radio, and I've had a lot of friends on with me, and I also had the opportunity to talk to people that I now consider friends that I'd never met before when they found out about the podcast. And I'm just so proud of the man that you have become after all these years. And I'm just excited to be able to connect with you again. And man, tell people how they can connect with you and your associations with social media and things like that.
Well, thank you. And I want to be selfish. Can we please do this again in about 6 months? Nothing I love more than talking about radio, and I've got a lot of radio stories I could tell, but
I'll do that. I'll put it on my calendar.
Do you know about the sound check site? It's called realradio.com, R-E-E-L.
Uh-uh.
So I stumbled on this thing about 8 or 9 years ago. It's air checks from the 50s on. It's Lujack. Cool. It's Landecker. It's Klein at WHBQ. And they got into a little issue because a lot of those air checks had music.
Uh-huh.
And I intervened and kind of helped them get the right kind of license for it. And then the guy that did it passed away, and it went down. And you're going to make me go look at it. I haven't seen it in about a year, but I'm a subscriber. But all your radio guys, realradio.com, then thank me. Oh, my God. It's everybody. It's the real Don Steele. It's unbelievable.
Right.
It's Grease Man. I mean,
oh,
it's
just, the Grease Man. Huh?
There's thousands of hours of this stuff. My wife got mad at me when I first described because I don't think – I ate dinner for about a week, but I just had to bring that up. But ours, we're NashvilleSongwriters.com. Our socials are all at NSAI Official.
Okay. And you also have this YouTube channel that you interview songwriters with?
Well, that's actually for the Gannett newspaper chain, Tennessean and Gannett papers across America. I think they park them on YouTube. But if you go to Tennessean.com, click on music and click on story behind the song. I do an interview about one song every Sunday, and favorite thing I've done since radio, got to tell you, David, I love doing that.
Oh, I bet you do, because some of these songwriters, they have great stories behind the song itself and what was the inspiration behind some of those. And man,
let's see if you remember this. It's a pop song. Dan, 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 dan. Devil Inside. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
I got that's going to be one of the next ones. I just got done. Did a couple with Andrew Ferris from NXS. I mean, I love doing this series, man.
Well, you know, just kind of an offshoot of that, because I know that music stars and performers and songwriters, they're also fans. And several years ago when I was in Mid-Missouri, I had an opportunity to introduce Vince Gill at one of his concerts. And as I was standing off stage and his band was doing their warm-up, Vince Gill poked me on the shoulder and he said, Dave, I realize you're a music fan. I said, yeah. He says, well, look over at this guitar player. I said, okay. And he says, that's the guy that came up with the guitar riff for Oh, Pretty Woman. And my
Oh, that was Harold Bradley.
Yeah. And my jaw dropped. You know, I was just...
In fact, he's playing that guitar riff on Pretty Woman. Harold was, yeah.
Yeah, and I just about died when he said that. And Vince said, you know what? I still, to this day, at times will look over and see that talented man and what he meant to music history and just how it, you know, it just floored Vince Gill of all people. You know, I'm a big Vince Gill fan and a wonderful man on top of that, too. But these guys that I've had a few opportunities to meet, they're also fans, and I love to talk to them about who they are fans of. And it's just been fascinating for you to tell these stories about you getting to talk to some of these people and the songwriters and how they've reacted and how the work you are doing is helping that songwriting industry. And I'm just so glad to have you on it. Yeah, I'm going to put you down as get in touch with you in a few months, and we'll do this again, man.
Yeah, we just won a big trial, the largest digital pay raise for songwriters ever. So we're going to plow forward. And I can't tell you how fun this has been. And thank you, Dave. I really appreciate it, man.
Well, Bart, it's been just nothing but a pleasure. And I will send you a link to this. And we are on several of the podcasting formats. We're still building our audience. So spread the word. You know, any radio people that you know.
Oh, we'll post it. You'll get a bunch of songwriters there on it, I guarantee.
That's fantastic. And I would love to talk to them, too, if they want to talk about. One of the things I would like to do is talk to a songwriter.
Well, I'm going to tell you the guy you need to get, not to interrupt, you need to get Bobby Tomblin.
Okay.
Bobby had his first radio station show down in Andalusia, Luverne, Alabama, when he was 8.
Wow.
Bobby's spending a lot of time in Henry County now. Bobby and I do a road trip every year to go visit some of our chapters just so we can talk about radio. I'll connect
awesome.
That with you. And I'm going to connect you with Big Jim Sykes, who was in Paris with us, that now runs Elvis Radio for Sirius XM.
And really, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, if you knew how to get in touch with him. I've had the opportunity to talk to Jack Parnell. I think the last I heard that was in Milan, Tennessee. And Jack used to do WHBQ and WMC in Memphis, one of the first jocks to ever play Elvis. And I just think it's interesting to talk to radio people about radio and music. And then I've had the opportunity to talk to people that don't do music but are still on radio, sportscasters and newscasters. It's just a fascinating industry that is undergoing some changes. And I think you've helped me kind of get that thought process. That change is not necessarily bad, but there's also some positives that can come from that. And I appreciate that, Bart. I really do.
Yeah, we're all just trying to figure out what the path forward is, and we will. Different, but we will.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bart, for joining us on Radio Guy Reflections. And like I said, I'll get in touch with you in a few more months. We'll set up this to do again, and we'll just have some more fun talking radio.
My pleasure, man. Thanks.
And that's Radio Guy Reflections, a podcast about radio and the people behind the microphone. In future podcasts, we'll look at what makes a successful and sometimes a train wreck of a radio show.
As we say in the radio business, if you put that on the radio, people will listen to it.
We'll talk with people who started in radio and moved on to success in other fields. Radio Guy Reflections. We'll be back soon with another show about radio and the men and women who produce the radio programs you've loved to listen to. Radio Guy Reflections is a production of Dave's Voice Works.